get going, friend. So I'm not sure how many shirim this will take. Probably, I would say probably three, if I had to guess. But a very, very important topic of Amira La'akum, of effectively, and this is really the title that I gave for it, is really outsourcing malacha. And we're so familiar with the concept of outsourcing today to other countries or to other people at least. Delegating malacha, outsourcing malacha, that's really what it is. It's the realization that I can't do malacha on my own, so my next natural move would obviously be to just get somebody else to do the malacha for me, and whereas I may well be steering clear of just having somebody who's, you know, chas v'shalom, just having a non-observant Jew perform malacha for me, hopefully that would never even cross our minds, but what would be a very reasonable thing really to cross our minds would be ask a non-Jew to do the work for you. And I say this particularly because we are very well acquainted that within the parameters and within the framework of Judaism, there is this, we don't live with the sense that all the rest of the world ought to be doing the same things that we are, which is a fundamentally different approach to religion and to observance and relationship with God than many other religions have, which is effectively that whatever it is that the adherents to that religion are actually observing and actually maintaining, really everybody else in the world ought to be doing also. They're just not. They're non-observers. And we don't really feel that way. We feel that we might have one path, one approach, one mahalach for Jews, and then another for non-Jews. And by the way, whenever Amir La'akum does come up, I always try to make a point of explaining this. Or whenever there's a scenario when appropriately giving away, let's say, something that's not kosher, I always try to make this point. I'm not trying to put my sins on you. I'm not just trying to put a stumbling block in your way. I don't really believe that anybody who's not Jewish should be keeping Shabbos, needs to keep Shabbos, that there's any obligation. I think it's really worth spelling that out because especially coming from a different religious vantage point, It's really compromising, or it can seem really compromising that here you're trying to basically just trip me up, and nothing could be further from the truth. So it all seems very reasonable and all seems appropriate. We know that that's not the case. That as much as there might be certain circumstances in which it is permissible to ask a non-Jew, generally speaking, we say not. So it's worth first of all just getting, and this year is really going to be probably something of a shorter shiur, but getting some of the background, more of the real pressing questions that we have about housekeepers and cleaning help and neighbors and passersby and things like that. Probably going to be addressed over the next couple of shiurim, but really understanding some of the backdrop, the background material, the building blocks of what this prohibition is all about is going to stand us in good stead when it comes to some of the more practical questions as we get to them. Number one, let's talk about the actual reasons as to why this is prohibited. I don't know if it's the most obvious or not, but maybe the most popular, or maybe the one that we would naturally expect, is the approach of the Rambam. When the Rambam discusses Amir La'akum, when he discusses the idea of trying to outsource our malacha to a non-Jew, he says that effectively this is an issue of treating Shabbos lightly. And what he means by treating Shabbos lightly is that if I get in the habit of asking a non-Jew to perform the malacha for me, you understand how, at least over time, or desensitizes us to the idea of malacha. It's this very difficult kind of place that we're in. On the one hand, we believe that only Jews ought to be keeping Shabbos. Only Jews are prohibited from doing malacha. On the other hand, if I can just outsource everything to a butler who follows me around all Shabbos long, and I can ask him to do whatever it is that I might want done for me, so it gets to a point where I see that for the farce that it certainly feels like, really, and I come to do the malacha myself. That's really the kicker. The Rambam is concerned that we will end up doing malacha ourselves, or at least that's the way that the Rambam views this concern as initiated by Chazal, this original prohibition. Speak about the ramifications of that in just a minute. Let's talk about a couple of other approaches. Actually, Rashi, in two different places in Shas, speaks about these two different possibilities, two different ideas. One is that this might fall under what's really a much larger rubric that maybe we'll dedicate a series of shiurim to in the future, which is non-Shabbos speech, daber davar. When everybody says, unfortunately, but it's become almost tongue-in-cheek, like, nish Shabbos karet, but, you know, I shouldn't be talking about this, but if I could talk about whatever I'm not really supposed to talk about, then I would say the following. So sometimes we really follow up that phrase with speech that's actually permitted on Shabbos, but it at least is suggestive of the reality that there are many things that we're really not allowed to talk about on Shabbos, whether it's just as an ideal, and some things that are genuinely, genuinely prohibited. What am I not allowed, just generally, what am I not allowed to talk about on Shabbos? Not allowed to talk about malacha. Not allowed to talk about doing malacha. And I'm certainly not allowed to speak explicitly about doing malacha. Even when it comes to certain activities that I might be discussing that I'm going to take care of that night or the next day, when there is a heter to do so, it is provided that there be no explicit reference to malacha. Meaning that there may well be a difference between saying, I'm going somewhere and I'm driving somewhere. I'm going probably suggests that the only means of actually getting there would be to drive, but I'm not actually making reference explicitly to the malacha as opposed to saying that I'm driving there, which very much does. If I approach a non-Jew and I say, would you turn the light on for me for Shabbos? Let's make it as explicit as that. Could you turn the light on for me? Could you turn my crock pot on for me? Could you turn the oven back on for me? Can you reset the timer or whatever it is?
That's a different halachic issue to have a non-Jew turn your oven on or whatever. No?
It would be Amir La'akum. It would be Amir La'akum. Meaning to ask him to do so.
Not because it's Shabbos.
Oh, seriously. Let's assume that everything is cooked already. We're dealing with food.
Okay.
That's also easier because then we're isolating the Bishul issue also. Just the act of turning on the oven,
okay.
And then I'll take care of everything. I'll put the food in or all the food is cooked anyway already and whatever it is. So we're right at the top. So the question is Amir La'akum really its own independent issur, or does it fall under the rubric of the previous prohibition of not being permitted to talk about malacha generally on Shabbos? If I can't talk about malacha in general, then I also couldn't ask a non-Jew to do work for me on Shabbos. Another possibility, as a general rule of thumb, well, we'll put it this way. We know that broadly there is a concept of a shliach, in many different capacities in halacha, that if for whatever reason I can't either discharge my obligation by myself, or if there's something, a halachic process that needs to be carried out, then I can appoint an agent on my behalf to be able to do so for me. Generally speaking, that applies only Jew to Jew. We don't find that there is a concept of shlichus. We don't find that there's a concept of agency, halachic agency, when it comes to a Jew appointing a non-Jew to do something on his or her behalf on Shabbos. However, here, this may well be its own independent prohibition or its own gezerah that effectively works with shlichus and just extends it to an area where it ordinarily doesn't exist. What lurks behind that, presumably, is something that is at least akin to the Rambam's concern. You're treating Shabbos lightly, or you're going to end up with a complete balagan where you have everybody asking everybody else to, well, all the other non-Jews on the block to do malacha for them, and that's going to be an infraction of covered Shabbos or treating Shabbos seriously, or maybe we'll ultimately come to do malacha ourselves on Shabbos, God forbid. So these are oftentimes stated as sort of three independent reasons, depending on how you look at it. The first issue may actually just be what is present behind the other two, at least to some degree, or at least that the first issue is really behind the third one. The third one, in speaking about shlichus, is really dealing more with the actual mechanism at play, how it is that this works. These are the mechanics of this prohibition. There may be example. There's a difference between speaking about what computers can do and how to actually construct one, right? I might have an interest in creating an airplane, but then you need to discuss how it actually happens. What are the mechanics? What are the components? How does it actually work? I get it. It would be wonderful to be able to fly and to be able to traverse great distances in the air. That sounds wonderful, but how do you actually go about achieving that goal? So it may be that, let's say, one and three to some degree might actually work sort of well with one another. The Rambam says that this is just prohibited because you're going to end up treating Shabbos lightly. It could be that what Rashi is addressing when he speaks about shlichus is that this is the actual mechanism by which it takes place, by which it's made usser. Any way you slice it, there may be certain things that fall through the gaps, or certain activities, certain types of instruction, or certain types of requests that I might make of a non-Jew that slip between the cracks of some of these, but if we look at them comprehensively, and the poskim do look at them comprehensively, then ultimately they'll all be usur anyway. Example, is it permissible to ask a non-Jew on Shabbos to do work for you after Shabbos? Not work, to do malacha for you after Shabbos. Can I ask a non-Jewish friend that I meet up with on Shabbos to please swing by the house at 9:30 p.m. well after Shabbos is over to pick me up for that thing that we were going to go to together? I don't know, you know, a Saturday night office party or whatever it is. If the issue is that this is some element of shlichus, right, that he's effectively acting as my agent, no problem. So he's acting as my agent long after Shabbos is over. Meaning, if the problem is agency, now I've asked him, or I've instructed or requested that he do something for me on Shabbos, but by the time that's actually fulfilled, it's going to be after Shabbos. So then there hasn't actually been any infraction. By the time he's acting on my behalf, it's actually permissible to me to do exactly what he's doing also. If you say, though, that either this is an issue of Daber Davar, that you're not speaking about Shabbos-dik things on Shabbos, you're speaking about Malacha, whenever that Malacha is fulfilled, I'm still speaking about Malacha on Shabbos, that'll still be prohibited. If it's generally an issue, maybe this is debatable, but it could be that if you just... The Rambam speaks about this in both capacities anyway, but meaning if it's an issue of treating Shabbos lightly, then it could be no matter when the Malacha is actually being done, getting into the habit of asking somebody to do Malacha for you on Shabbos, even if I don't want them to do it for me until after Shabbos is over, just having that conversation might still be enough to potentially lead me to actually violate the Malacha myself, maybe. What about the reverse? What about asking a non-Jew before Shabbos to do Malacha for me on Shabbos? So now that can't be an issue of prohibited speech, because there's no prohibition against speaking about Malacha on Friday, before Shabbos, on Erev Shabbos. But there would be a problem if, let's say, you speak about agency. If by the time he is fulfilling that act of Malacha, it already is Shabbos, and at that point, it's actually usur for me to do so as well. So any way you slice it, all of those scenarios are going to be prohibited, whether it's asking for Malacha to be done on Shabbos, whether it's asking on Shabbos for Malacha to be done after Shabbos, or asking before Shabbos for Malacha to be done on Shabbos. All of those are going to be prohibited. This is casting a pretty wide net. Again, we're not really going to get into that many actual, maybe to some degree, but into actual heterim so much this week, but we will get to those things. What am I allowed to ask in what instances? What about arranging services that are going to be taken care of on Shabbos, but I arrange them obviously before Shabbos? When are those things going to be permitted and when are they going to be prohibited? Again, we'll lay out some of the foundation here, but we'll get into some more of the details in the next couple of weeks. Let's speak about the actual scope then of the prohibition. So this is probably the biggest number one misconception when it comes to Amir al-Akam, and it is the number one biggest deal. And even though this is sort of background information, it absolutely colors the rest of the conversation, and so many of the things that we might think either are maybe are totally mutter, maybe are totally us, are very, very important reality. I'm actually going to read it directly. This is, the Shulchan Aruch says as follows, in Reish Ayin Vav. He says, Eino Yehudi Shehidlik Esaner Bishvil Yisrael. If a non-Jew lights a candle, lights a, you know, whatever it is, oil lamp or candle, whatever the case is, for the sake of a Jew, Asur Lakol. It's prohibited to everybody. Afilu Lumi Shelo Hudlak Bishvilo. Even for somebody else. So meaning, the non-Jew lights it for Reuven. Shimon is not allowed to benefit from that light. What is so critical about this halacha in the Shulchan Aruch is that in the context of our conversation, what you'll find conspicuously absent in this particular halacha is that there is no mention of Reuven or Shimon or anybody ever making the request. This means that the non-Jew is doing it on his own for the sake of a Jew, and the Jew is still not permitted to actually accept or actually benefit from that labor, from that malacha on Shabbos. This is a huge, huge deal. Huge deal. Because a whole number of reasons. Largely, I think, whether we are or are not familiar with all the ins and outs that are required to make Amir al-Akam mutter, but once it happened, it happened. Once it happened, it happened. Okay, so maybe I messed up. Maybe I should have hinted a little more. I didn't exactly hint enough. But, okay, you know, what's done is done. Or that I didn't even ask. I didn't even ask. They came in for some completely different purpose. They came in for babysitting. They came in to to clean or whatever. And then they also happened to turn on the light that I very much wanted to be on. But I didn't request it. So then I should be able to benefit from it. The reality is, and this may or may not be a direct extension of Amir La'akum, just for simplicity's sake, let's work with that approach that in the interest of ensuring that Amir La'akum would not actually happen, the Chachamim further prohibited even deriving benefit from the act even after it's taken place, even if I didn't actually ask for it. So effectively, malacha that was performed by a non-Jew for a Jew on Shabbos, you can't benefit from, whether you asked for it or not. This might, again, just be sort of a secondary kind of gezeira, secondary sort of prohibition, in order to ensure that the first one would actually be adhered to. Makes a very, very big difference. By the way, another area where this makes a big difference is that we just need to be in this mindset. If malacha happens on Shabbos, the knee-jerk reaction should be that I can't benefit from it until proven otherwise. So that also means children. Also means kids, right? It's true that I didn't ask the child to do it, but that's only one piece of it, right? That the kids do it naturally on their own, I may now be in a position where I can't even benefit from the activity of, let's say, you know, a two-year-old or a three-year-old or whatever, even if I didn't ask for it at all, or even if it was really just, Shmushkin, you know what to do. And you hold them up near the light and then flip it on. So again, knee-jerk reaction needs to be that that's prohibited, except for some scenarios that we'll discuss beginning right now. So the other item to keep in mind here is we have to be aware of varying degrees of benefit that might be gained from whatever malacha that was actually done. First and foremost, and the most obvious one, is really true direct benefit. And direct benefit that was not present previously. Easiest example, there's a raw challenge sitting in the crock pot. Why is there a raw challenge sitting in the crock pot? Because I forgot to turn it on before Shabbos. So now I have somebody else turn it on. I have a non-Jew turn it on Shabbos. Again, not dealing with, is this an extenuating circumstance? Might this be permitted actually? But just for simplicity's sake, start off with raw food, and now a non-Jew cooks it for me on Shabbos. Isn't it also an issue of Bishul Akum potentially? Fine. But just zeroing in on this one issue, if I have the non-Jew cook something for me on Shabbos, that is a direct benefit of the malacha of Bishul. Previously, before Bishul was done, I didn't have food to eat. Now the malacha of Bishul is done, and now there is a prepared pot of food for me to eat. So that becomes usher for me to derive benefit from on Shabbos. That is direct benefit. It's producing something that wasn't there previously. Some poskim discuss the idea of direct but secondary benefit. What's direct but secondary benefit? So here's an example. No Erev. There's no Erev, or I live beyond the Erev, or whatever. You know, it happens once every couple of years, so there's no Erev for Shabbos. And let's say, leave my key and shul, and I needed to get into, let's remove it from directly, let's say getting into my house. I need something from the storage unit. I need something from the storage unit, right? I live in an apartment, I need something from the storage unit, and it's a separate key, and I don't have the key, I have the key in somebody else's apartment or whatever it is. So can I ask my non-Jewish neighbor to, or can I have my non-Jewish neighbor, can I benefit from the fact that my non-Jewish neighbor now brings it to me in a place where I could now use it? So really the malacha that was done was hotza'ah, bringing the key from one place to another place. But now the key is here. Key's here already. The benefit is that I got the key. Great, but now that malacha has basically ended. That malacha is over now. What I would do is I would pick up the key and I would put it in the lock and I would turn it, I would swing the door open, I would take out whatever I need. Is that permissible to do on Shabbos? Meaning, is that really direct benefit from that which the non-Jew did? Or is that not exactly direct benefit? So it's somewhere in between. Rav Shlomo Zalman has a long piece saying that this is not acceptable, that this is still considered direct benefit, albeit a secondary benefit. What do I want the key for? Why does anybody ever want to have a key? The reason why you want to have a key is because you want to be able to access whatever it is that's locked behind the door that the key is going to open. So that effectively is the direct benefit. There are going to be certain malachas like that, that when it comes to hotzah, it's not that I gain from the actual act of carrying or transporting. What I gain from is that now I have this item here in this place. Maybe you can make the argument that if, let's say, food was carried, now I have food where I need to be able to eat it, so even eating it in that location would be even more primary kind of benefit. But this sort of scenario where you've brought me something that I can now utilize for another action, another activity, so that would be secondary benefit. Generally speaking, we would presume that that would be prohibited as well. Then there is indirect benefit. Indirect benefit is really often referred to as siluk, or removing, siluk piron, something that's bothering you, removal of something that's annoying. There is a huge distinction between, let's say, turning a light on and turning a light off. Direct benefit, certainly usser. Whether you asked for it or didn't ask for it, it is absolutely usser in almost all circumstances, in almost all scenarios. Indirect benefit, once it's happened, you can generally derive benefit from. Why? Because there's nothing to actually derive benefit from. It's the removal of something that's intrusive, bothersome, as opposed to something that's been produced or created. There's a difference between producing light and just removing light. So if I'm in my room and I can't sleep, there's a major difference between, let's say, somebody turning the light on and turning the light off. Again, let's assume that all these things are happening even without asking. I had somebody over in the house, and she was babysitting, whatever it was, something that was totally, totally mutter, it completely bereft of any malacha. But as she's going through that, this has certainly happened to us at all in different occasions. That, oh, that's funny, that light is on, that light is on. Right? It's like, very polite, use the bathroom, turn the light off in the bathroom, come in, there are no lights on, I need the bathrooms, that kind of thing. So I wasn't able to take a nap in my, a Shabbos nap in my room because the lights were on. Now guess what? The lights are off, so now I can actually benefit from that because there really isn't anything that I'm actually benefiting from. Similarly, here's a very, very good practical issue. An alarm is going off. An alarm is going off. So a non-Jew doing that or turning off the alarm is very, very different from actually turning something on. Even though it might be the actual same malacha that's involved, at least conceptually, between, let's say, turning a crock pot on and turning an alarm off is far better. Again, it needs to be done properly, but at least in terms of the actual benefit, that would be something that I could derive benefit from. It's not like I have to now leave my house, because before the house was basically uninhabitable because the alarm was shrieking in my ear, and now it's not, and now it's so much more pleasant to be in the house, therefore I actually can't be in my house because that benefit was brought about by the non-Jew. It is permissible to benefit from that activity. Then there's this in between. What about additional benefit? So generally, this is viewed in the same category as indirect benefit, but it is a little bit different. So as the most obvious example, let's talk about lights. Lights being turned on, direct benefit. Now I can see. Now there is light where there was an absence before. Now I can read. Now I can play a game. And before I couldn't. Indirect benefit is where that light is removed. The light was bothering me. And now there's no light, and now I can go to sleep. What if it was kind of light, and now it's lighter? Now it's really bright. So the light was off in the den, but the light was on in the hall. So I could sit in the den. I have to strain my eyes a little bit. It's annoying. It's not so pleasant. It's kind of dark. We could open up the blinds. But now there's more light. So that's really additional benefit, right? It's not that I was in a position before where there is no means for me to be able to do whatever I wanted to do. It's just that now it's facilitated to a greater degree, and therefore that would also be permissible. Again, this doesn't get into whether or not it's permissible to ask that these things be done. generally, amir la'akum. I can't ask for these things to be done. The question is, if they were done, can I derive benefit from them? If it's additional benefit, yes. By the way, when it comes to light, there are two scenarios, therefore, I think, that we need to be careful. Maybe three scenarios. One would be some area of the house where there really is no light other than the one light in that room, which in like a fairly open floor plan, it's maybe hard to conjure up. Two considerations would maybe be a bathroom and a basement. If all the lights are off in the basement, then you really can't see anything. If you have a light on someplace on the, you know, on one of the floors of your house, for the most part, that's enough to be able to see and to be able to look around. It does, though, and here's the second issue to keep in mind, does depend on the activity. I might be able to read a really huge Uno card. So if I was going to play Uno with my kids, I could do it in a rather dark room. Now there's more light. Matov manayim, that's wonderful. It's that much more pleasant, that much easier. Fine. If I wanted to read a book, then I can't necessarily read a book in a room that's not really well lit. So that would be problematic. So it's going to depend on the space, also going to depend on the activity. If it's an activity that I really could have done here with a little bit of light, so then I'm still in the clear, even though it's now made that much brighter because the babysitter left the lights on now in this room. But if this room, even though it's not that I'm in danger of bumping into the side of the couch or bumping into a wall, it's not like it's pitch black, but I wasn't able to, let's say, read the paper, read a magazine, read a sefer, something with small print. Now I'm able to. That becomes more problematic. Okay. Let's talk about the actual malacha. So this is where we have to be acquainted with the actual degrees of malacha that might be performed. Meaning to say that there's a difference between a malacha d'oraisa and a malacha d'rabbanan with respect to amir la'akum. And this is, again, if this is something that was done, we're not yet speaking about whether or not it's permitted for me to ask for these things and how I have to go about asking for these things. We'll get to that, Amir Tzashem, next week. But meanwhile, if the malacha was done, then there would be a distinction between a d'oraisa and a d'rabbanan in the following capacity. If it was a malacha d'oraisa, it's prohibited to everyone. This is what the Shulchan Aruch means when he's talking about shehidlik asaner b'shvili Yisrael. Now, asr lakol, afilu misha lo hudlak b'shvilo. The reason why it's asr to everybody is because lighting a candle on Shabbos is a malacha d'oraisa. So not only, let's say the you have a completely darkened area and now the non-Jew lights a candle in that room or in the basement, in the dungeon, in the attic, wherever it is, it was completely, completely dark. And now, or just a completely darkened building, right? You can imagine, mincha time, right? It's already getting pretty dark in a shul. Shul's probably a bad example. Let's say in my home, so before electricity, so the sun is going down and now it's completely dark. So having the non-Jew light a candle means that you can walk around a house that previously had absolutely no light in it. That would be not only usher for me to reside in, it would be usher for everybody else to also make use of that space as well. So it's not even like I could just clear it. Well, you know, when I have company over, or you know, people want to come over for a while, I'll excuse myself and I'm going to go to bed anyway. I'm not feeling that great. Let everybody else have free reign of the house. That would be problematic for others as well. If it is a malacha d'rabbanan, so it is prohibited only to the one for whom the malacha was intended. But it would be mutter to everybody else. So this is probably the biggest, this rears its head probably more frequently than any other malacha where this could be problematic, is with respect to electricity, or this is going to become complicated when it comes to electricity. Major, major question amongst the poskim as to whether using electricity on Shabbos is a malacha d'oraisa or a malacha d'rabbanan. Some assume that it's a malacha d'rabbanan. If it's a malacha d'rabbanan, so then that's where these distinctions are going to be, that it's only going to be prohibited for me if the intention was that babysitter's in the house. She knows that we like to have the basement lights on for the kids to be able to go downstairs and play. So she turns it on, keeping the kids in mind, and then the kids can't really play there. Could somebody else go down there for some other reason, play with some other person's kid comes over and they want to go and get a game or that kind of thing, then you know, then they could. But if it's a malacha del reisa, which it might be, discussion amongst the poskim, so then this would be prohibited to everybody. Nobody would be able to go in and use that space. Okay. When is it mutter? It would be mutter if the non-Jew does it for himself. There are a couple of caveats to that. That when it's done for himself, so there would still be, if both of these are true, then there may still be a problem. One is if, yes, I'm putting the lights on, babysitter's putting the lights on because he or she wants them to be on, let's say, for herself. But if there is a good relationship that exists between the non-Jew and the Jew, so then even though it was really done for the non-Jew himself, the idea that there is still a certain measure of camaraderie and goodwill towards the Jew, that could be problematic because, or in an instance in which there's also the problem of Shema Yarbia Bishvilo. If we are concerned that this might be something that could be increased or would be increased for the sake of the Jew as well. So the classic example of this comes to cooking. And you have to try to avoid the actual Bishul Akum issues on this. Let's just assume it's something as simple as boiling water on Shabbos. So if a non-Jewish babysitter wants to boil a kettle of water, boiled water doesn't fall under the prohibition of Bishul Akum. So she did it for herself, put up a kettle of hot water, the urn was out or was plugged in or whatever. Can I use the leftover water now? Wasn't done for me, it was done for herself. But if there is the concern, and in this case, chances are anybody that you have in your home who's watching your children, there's a fair measure of goodwill between the parties, then there may be something in the back of her mind about, you know what, I'm really just making a cup of tea for myself, but I know that they can't cook on Shabbos, and I know that it would probably be beneficial, and everybody on a cold winter Saturday afternoon wouldn't mind sitting down to a cup of hot tea. So if there is even the possibility that one might increase, that the non-Jew might increase the measure of whatever it is that he or she is doing for the sake not only then of themselves, but also for the sake of the Jew, that could still be problematic. So, for instance, fundamental distinction between, let's say, heating up water and turning on a light. Turning on a light is a zero-sum game. The light is either on or the light is off. You don't increase the number of lights that are going to be turned on in the room for the number of people who are actually going to be in that room. If it's got to be light, it's got to be light. If it's got to be bright, it's got to be bright. If she wants to sit down on the couch in this particular room or in the basement or whatever and turn on the lights that she can see, so then there's no manner of her being able to that we need to be concerned that, yeah, but maybe she's going to turn on extra lights for the sake of the Jews in the home. That's an impossibility. That would be a completely different act or a whole other activity of turning on another light in another room. In terms of whatever light she put on for herself, then that could certainly be utilized by the Jew as well. Again, none of this, just want to emphasize this again, none of this deals with the question of whether or not it is permitted to ask the non-Jew to actually do that. What we're talking about here is it mutter for me to derive benefit from that which was actually done? And if the answer is yes to some of those, or to certain types of malacha, then we can start making a case in certain circumstances, certain scenarios, for perhaps actually asking her in the first place to do it for me. In a scenario in which the malacha was performed in a manner that I can't actually derive any benefit from, so then the question becomes, so how long, when do I get to derive benefit from it? And we should just be aware of the following, that in those instances, what's spoken about is the shear of bichdei sheyasu, the amount of time that it would take to perform that malacha myself after Shabbos, meaning that it would still be considered to be a derivation of benefit if immediately after Shabbos I have hot water, and ordinarily it takes me 10 minutes to, everything happens so immediately now, but that theoretically I just saved 10 minutes because right after Shabbos the hot water is already there, as opposed to needing to wait the full measure of time that it would take to heat the hot water, so I would still be deriving benefit from the malacha that was done on Shabbos. A light doesn't take any time to flick on. So obviously, immediately after Shabbos, I could start deriving benefit from the room that was lit. But depending on what the malacha is, if this is some sort of more complicated process, the laundry was done, food was made in a way that, again, wouldn't consider, or if even just food was heated, right? Food was heated. Let's say you had food that was already cooked, but a non-Jew turned on the oven and heated that food, and now there's piping hot food immediately after Shabbos. Those sorts of instances where really what's happening is something that's a much longer process. It takes a while to unfold. Utilizing that process, deriving benefit from that process immediately after Shabbos is effectively deriving benefit from that malacha. So what needs to happen is there needs to be a waiting period whereby we say that now sufficient time has passed after Shabbos. If I had done it myself, it would also be ready right now. If the moment Shabbos was over, I had started that malacha. By now, it would still be prepared, and I'd be able to utilize it myself. Then there's no compunction about utilizing whatever it is that the non-Jew did. So that is basically laying the foundation for the kinds of malacha that I could potentially derive benefit from or not derive benefit from. Just going to underscore this one more time. That's not saying that therefore all those kinds of things can be asked for, that we can approach a non-Jew and say, listen, there's already light on in my house. It would provide additional benefit if you were to turn on another light in another room for me. I can basically see in that room, would you mind turning on the lights for me and then I could derive benefit from it? That wouldn't be okay. Indirect benefit. The lights are on in my room. It's a pain in the neck. Do me a favor. Turn off the lights for me. That would be great. And then I could take a nap. It's only indirect benefit. After all, it should be permissible. If even after the fact I messed up and, oh, you know what? I wasn't supposed to ask, but you know what? I did already. And I know that my rabbi holds that electricity is only an issur derabanan. So at the very least, I can invite all my friends over and they could utilize the light that's now on in the basement or whatever. Not necessarily so when it comes to actually asking for these things. So Mirtz Hashem, next time we'll get into how you go about asking. When it comes to those kinds of malacha that we may benefit from if they're done, then we'll have to have a conversation about whether or not it's permitted to ask, in what scenarios, in what environment, and then how we actually go about doing it. Okay, let's pause it there.